So, tonight, I would like to just give a little bit of a kind of smallish Dharma talk about what it means to try to bring the Dharma into your life, to lead a life, to lead a Dharma life, to expand on your practice, or even to deepen your practice, though I don't want to really get caught up in ideas of a shallow practice or a deeper practice, but more ways to kind of bring the practice into new areas of your life. I'm going to talk a little bit about sitting and sitting practices at home and retreats and stuff like that. But I'm also going to talk about a whole bunch of other ways that one might practice. And I don't want anybody to fall into the trap of defining your Dharma practice as your sitting practice. Your sitting practice is part of your Dharma practice, perhaps an important part of your Dharma practice. But it isn't it isn't the most important part. It's a important part, and if it's the only part of your Dharma practice, then you have misunderstood the nature of the Dharma. So, a lot of times, sitting is really strongly emphasized, and there's this kind of unspoken or sometimes even spoken thing that more is better. And that even more is even better still, and I don't think that's true. I think if you have I think that sitting is valuable, and if you have an affinity for it, you should do that. And at there are times in your life when more sitting is beneficial, and there's times in your practice. So. And part of what meditation does, kind of in the larger context of Zen teaching, is it kind of gives us a common base of language, a way to a kind of shared metaphor, a shared language of experience. And at the beginning part of your practice, it's important to be connecting to it, to be doing something. And sitting regularly is one way to do that. If you're going to start a sitting practice at home, it again isn't the case that that more is better, more often is better, or longer is better. What's good is to find something that is not oppressive for you, to find something that is that's sustainable, a sustainable level of effort. So maybe that's just coming here once a week. Maybe it's practicing at home three times a week. Maybe it's practicing a few minutes a day at home. If you're practicing at home, more important than duration is consistency, and to set an amount of time that you can actually do, and not can actually do in the sense of because you have the willpower, but will actually do. So maybe you'll decide that there is value to just sitting for 2 minutes a day, or 5 minutes, or 15. But what I encourage you to do is to decide before you sit down how long you're going to sit, and get a timer so that you don't have to judge it. And to sit for that amount of time. So part of what I'm just going to kind of give a list, maybe slightly elaborated on actually, I want to say a little bit more about sitting at home. Some people find it helpful to have a space dedicated to sitting. In the same way that when we come into this space, you know, it's kind of a cue for us. It kind of helps us, the space that we create and the energy we create together helps us to kind of remember our practice. So you may want to make an altar of some variety that's meaningful to you at home, or just have like a corner of your bedroom. A lot of people find that a consistency of time of day is helpful. So you may want to practice first thing in the morning or last thing before bed, during your lunch hour, or on. You can even do practice as you're commuting, unless you're at the wheel of your car driving, in which case, please do driving practice. And your daily practice need not necessarily be meditation. It could be a recitation of the five remembrances. It could be, which is a powerful, powerful teaching. One Tibetan teacher whose stuff I'm working on right now, he says that if you don't remember death, you don't remember the Dharma. That's a powerful practice there. Or Tori Zenji's Bodhisattva's Vow is what I find a particularly useful thing to kind of reconnect me. Some of the other liturgy pieces that we do, like the Shosan Myokichijo Dorani, which on an important level really doesn't mean anything, makes it very adaptable to all kinds of circumstances. And there's a way in which chanting practice or sutra practice or recitation of a dharani can be kind of like prayer, but not really. It's when I hear of some tragedy in the world, or when I am commemorating some death, or when I know a friend is sick or ailing, I do the Shosan Myokichijo Dorani, and I offer incense at my altar. It's a way of there's a way in which these kinds of practices are really beautifully and importantly on the line between doing something and doing nothing. They're not nothing, and obviously my chanting a Dorani for, you know, world suffering doesn't cause suffering to cease in the world, in one sense. In another sense, perhaps it does. But it's a way of connecting, of responding to anything in the world with a kind of Dharma heart. The Nembutsu practice that I've talked about also which is just simply the recitation of Namo Amida Buddha, being one with Amida Buddha, you can use it even as a shorter dharani, and it's an acknowledgement that there's nothing you can do, and that you're giving yourself over to the compassion of the universe. And it doesn't even matter what's in your mind, but to come back to it, to do that, to come back to any practice, is part of the way we start to bring the Dharma into our life. So one Zen teacher, Reb Anderson at San Francisco Zen Center, he describes Zazen as a ceremonial practice of Zen, and there's a way in which even our meditation practice is a kind of ritual. It isn't the thing in itself. It's just a ritual which hopefully serves a purpose for us. So other ways to practice are to study, to read Dharma books. And this has been a big part of my path, and I really recommend it. And you have to do something to kind of pull the Dharma into your life. It could be chanting, it could be sitting, it could be studying, it could be just practicing mindfulness on a specific task as you wash the dishes, for instance, each night after a meal, just bringing your attention wholly and fully to that. It could be in the way you dedicate your efforts for the freedom and liberation of all beings. This is the Mahayana Bodhisattva path. Everything we do, we dedicate to the liberation of all beings. We can suffer for all beings. We can sit for all beings. We can wash the dishes for all beings. So the intention, the aspiration that you bring to whatever you do can be a way to bring the practice into your life. And then even if in the short term or foreseeable midterm, it doesn't actually change what you're doing. When you're going to work, to do whatever your job is, to either in the morning or kind of repeatedly throughout the day, to commit yourself to doing this activity for the salvation of all beings. Other people, there may be some phrase that kind of catches hold of your mind, such as being choicefully present, or such as practicing with the question of, well, what if that's not true? For everything you think, for every thought that arises in your mind, to interact with it, well, what if that's not true? And to practice vigilance, to be aware of what's going on in your mind, vigilance to the ways in which you are impulsively responding from grasping and aversion, to practice vigilance to the way that you've gotten caught in your own stories, to the way that your thoughts have become opaque to you. That's another way to practice. Chogyam Trungpa, the founder of the Shambhala tradition, one of the things that he says is a bodhisattva always apologizes first. And this has been something that I have taken up as a practice, and have a lot of, and have found it enormously valuable, and enormously valuable, in fact, to my relationship with my partner. So this is another way to practice, to practice looking for blaming whenever you're tempted to blame, to see if there's something that you can take responsibility for. And then there's the larger practice of universal responsibility, taking responsibility for the whole catastrophe of the state of the world. What are you going to do about it? Seriously, what are you going to do about it? That can be your Dharma practice. And it's important that to really make doing something about it, whatever your cause is, to make that Dharma practice, it's important to do it, to do right action without righteousness. Righteousness is actually a really strong root of evil. It's righteousness is the exact opposite of the not knowing that we vow to practice. But there still is right and wrong. There is stuff that needs to be done. And so do it in whatever way presents itself to you. Whatever way your karma, the particular collection of causes and conditions that are associated with this particular body and mind and experience and all that, wherever that takes you, there's an opportunity to practice. It may take you into peacekeeping on a kind of global or international level. It may be causes in the government and Congress. It may be just not turning away from the suffering that you see. And this is another way to continuously practice Dharma in your life, is to never turn away. One way to literally practice this that I try to engage with varying success is to always look at homeless people, to not turn away from that. It's a kind of suffering that we try to push away. And I try to always give them something, you know, because they say, can you spare change? And like, and I have an impulse, like, no, I can't, you know. But there's a practice of giving, of something. And sometimes I notice that in myself, that I say no or sorry and then walk away, and then I get half a block away and realize that I do in fact want to give them a dollar. Or that because that's who I mean to be. Being the person you mean to be is an important dharma practice. And again, this is a practice of giving it away, giving it all away. And it isn't for me to judge whether I like this person or don't like this person, whether I think they're going to do something that I want them to do with it or do something that I don't want them to do with it. That's not for me to judge. My practice is to see this and to respond to this suffering human being. And in fact, rare is the case that I can't give them some amount of money. And even if you can't, you can give them your humanity. You can look at them and acknowledge them as your brother and sister. You know, one of the things that always throws me about these homeless people is how sincerely they seem to say, God bless you, to me. And surely we can muster that amount of... I would like to be a person who can connect to that amount of humanity on a continual basis. Practicing the precepts that we recited today is another way to take up these practices. Some people put a copy of the precepts on their refrigerator to remind themselves of those things, of those aspirations. And again, like all parts of the practice, the precepts aren't something, they aren't a metric to judge our worth. They aren't something to decide that we're a bad or good person because we're having more or less difficulty with them. They're part of our aspiration. They're part of us trying to be the person who we need to be, trying to be a person who's bringing the Dharma into all of those aspects of your life. And so familiarity with the precepts is an important means for trying to keep them, which is why we occasionally do the recitation in the context of our liturgy here. And then there's taking jhakai, which is when you formally commit yourself to take up the ways of these precepts, which is what these little bibs are associated with. And this doesn't make you a better person. It doesn't even make you a better keeper of the precepts. And so in no way whatsoever do these things mean that the people who are wearing these are keeping the precepts better than the people who aren't. You know, and there's a way in which it's just the public act of doing that. You know, and then you get one of these things and you become then acutely aware of the precepts on an additional level than you are. And so part of what you become acutely aware of is all of the ways in which you still continue to break them. But even breaking is too strong a word. To rub up against them, to encounter them as Dharma gates to pass through. So it isn't about breaking or keeping, as if it's a binary thing and one is bad and one is good. It's engaging them as a practice. And it's the way we do jhukai, the precept ceremony in Boundless Way, is that in the jhukai ceremony, the people taking the precepts either extemporize or read a little prepared thing in response to each of the refuges, each of the pure precepts and each of the grave precepts, what that means to you. And the process of going through that is really powerful, of reflecting in that way and of saying those things in front of a group of people. And it's a big deal. In a way it's a big deal. And people's family come. Sometimes people's family even travel to come see it. Or it's nothing at all. Or it's just this small, intimate thing that you are doing for your own practice and for the salvation of all beings. There are other ways. Giving it away, giving away your practice. It's not yours. But all of the fruits of your practice, give them away. And when you're practicing vigilance with the three roots of suffering, grasping, aversion, and delusion, there's a practice of looking at your mind and seeing how often you say, I want, I need, I hate, I can't stand, I know. All of those are kind of can you can train yourself to notice those. You can train yourself to throw up the little yellow flag that whenever you say any of those things, there's something associated with grasping, aversion, or delusion going on there. Something for you to look at. And you know, and then there are retreats. In Boundless Way, we do three sesshin, which are the formal meditation retreats a year, and we do there's a all day meditation retreat once a month in Worcester. I encourage everybody to explore these, not because that's practice and the other stuff is not practice, but because that kind of starts to expand your relationship to all of your practice. The multi-day retreats cost money, but money should never be what keeps you away. And there's a sliding scale that slides down to zero. So if you have an inclination to do one, please do so. And other stuff can be worked out. You know, organizing stuff, helping. You know, there's ways in which we can all support each other's practice. You know, there are people who have picnics for the sangha, or who start reading groups, or who start dharma school or whatever for kids, or something. You know, give yourself to the sangha. All of these are ways to broaden, deepen, expand, connect to, give away your practice. I want to read a little passage from this book, which is by Jason Truman. I read from it a couple of years ago. He's a Zen teacher and a Kabbalist, Kabbalah. It's called The Instruction Manual for Receiving God. I'm going to read a little bit. Do not do spiritual practice as if your life depended on it. Practice as if it is your life. Let it be empty. Let it be light. Let it be sweet. Let each moment be a mystery that brings you to the next moment. The greatest spiritual practice is not yoga or prayer or meditation. It is life itself. And how we practice life tells us all. If you practice life in order to someday get good enough at it, to really live, then you are separate. Then you separate yourself from life in a profound way. But if your definition of life is that it has waves of up and down, joy and hardship, ease and discomfort, and if each day you practice being empty of preconceptions, ready to see what life brings, then you will be worthy of the concert stage. The instrument will be your own body, mind, and spirit. The audience will be all the Buddhas and ordinary people who enjoy watching humans be themselves. Does anybody? I'm gonna leave the traditional space to invite dialogue. Anybody wants to say anything about, well, what about, or to say something about some way in which you have taken up Dharma practice in your life, or some way in which you are struggling with taking up Dharma practice in your life, or anything else, please take this opportunity to do so, if you'd like. If you'd like to take up the practice of sharing your thoughts and your struggle and your practice with this group of spiritual friends, I encourage you to do that. It's a difficult practice. You know?
Mm. And I found it to be really useful because if I say that to myself, it becomes immediately clear what it is that I'm rubbing up against, you know, and where, and where I am as compared to everything else. So if ever I think that, you know, I'm not sure where my happiness is right at the moment or you know, what to work with, what brings it back to the
time? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent practice. That's Master Uman in Japanese, Yunmen in Chinese, who also said every day is a good day, which I have on a calligraphy at my desk at work. Yeah, there's nothing I dislike. So even there in your anger and suffering and hatred, there's nothing I dislike. What does that mean to engage that? That's a really rich practice. And you know, and this is another value of reading. You know, if you don't read Dharma books, then you're throwing yourself at the mercy of the random stuff that happens to occur to like me, for instance, to come out of my mouth, which I really wouldn't wish on any of you, you know? So please avail you yourselves of the carefully thought out words of the many masters and teachers and practitioners who have shared this path in the past, and part of doing that is that you come across something like there is nothing I dislike, and you're like, yeah, man, and then to really take it up, and to really use that. My teacher James, he would call that to take that up as a koan. But that is what you are doing. But that language kind of adds a level of mystery to it that's completely unnecessary. It's just to take it up as a touchstone, as a place to continually check in. Another one that I sometimes use is, what is this? What is here, right now? In this body and mind, what is here right now? To just look, not in some cosmic, mystical, seeing, like, ultimate nature thing, but what actually is going on? And another one that Ezra Beda talks about is, what is your most believed thought right now? That's a way of... So, there's nothing I dislike as a way of working with the mind of aversion. And what is your most believed thought is a way of working with the mind of ignorance.
Let's move along those lines. Striking the balance between... the righteousness and the tendency not to choose righteousness but to do right action, and how to kind of walk that line and the many ways it can present itself in daily life, and how that very easily can lead to judgment of other actions when there is right action. Righteousness is not a good course of action. It's a very difficult balance to walk.
And what's in part that you're right, and that's a huge practice. It might be that your touchstone is right action without righteousness, and to take up that is really, really rich. And things that I would invite you to look for are when anger is coming, and what are the beliefs that are underlying that anger. You know, and whenever we get righteous, we've divided the world into us and them. And that's not the way it is. That is the mind of ignorance, that us and them. Even that them is us. Even that person over there who has the wrong, twisted, hateful views causing suffering for so many people, that person is us too. And that is a suffering being, afflicted by, as we are, afflicted by delusion. And he's even more kind of possessed by that mind of by that mind of ignorance, and that's a cause for compassion to arise for this suffering being who has such the burden of holding these hateful views. And so, to in that context, to in the context of compassion and oneness, take right action, and to work diligently and realistically and actually for these, like the four commitments that we make, you know, a just economic order and equal rights and pardon and all of these things, to peace and all of that. You know, it isn't that, hey, whatever, war, it's all good. It's not all good. War is bad. And there's nothing I just want. And so there's a way to get that can come into that practice as well. And it isn't, and none of these things are about resolving it once and for all. So part of what the honest Dharma practice is in this situation is to just hold your heart open to the dissonance of wanting to do right and being aware of the downside of righteousness. And to just notice, even if you're questioning just a little bit, that maybe the righteousness is unnecessary, even if it still comes out, even if for whatever reason you still judge it necessary. I don't know if it is, but you might judge it necessary. But to just hold your heart open to the fact that, what if that's not true? And to be aware, to not be too quick to sublimate the difficult part of that encounter, to suppress it, but to do what you're doing in full, honest conflict is part of what it means to practice the Dharma. You know, and if you look at a lot of the people who we are tempted to point at and say, look what they're doing wrong, the thing that we're pointing at, aside from ourselves, but the other thing that we're pointing at is that things have gotten too simple. And when things get too simple for us and we become too sure that that's wrong and this is right, we're doing the exact same thing as that other hateful person who's...
It's hard not to have compassion and kind of get to know one better without creating some sort of internal hierarchy about
right.
Having compassion.
Right, there's a way that compassion can be condescension.
That can be translated in the mind to those poor people, those people that aren't as wise as I, kind of that,
right.
That type of mindset. I understand that what you're saying about compassion, and that's a suffering being as well as myself. For the that can become hierarchical thing. But we can't put it in the mind of that such.
So that's an important point, and that's something to be an important thing to be aware of. One kind of practice that there's some teacher, I forget who it is, says that one way to practice compassion is to recognize that's a being who suffers from sickness, old age, and death, just like us, a fellow sufferer of sickness, old age, and death. And you don't have you haven't mastered sickness, old age, and death. And loss and change and separation from what you like and association with what you dislike. Those things are collectively called by the Buddha the suffering of suffering. And that person is a fellow sufferer of suffering. And just to remember that there's that basic link of humanity. Even if you do nothing else, that's a transformative practice. Even if you don't get to any advanced stages of anything, but just to remember that whomever you're engaging in a conflict of views with, that person is a sufferer of suffering, just like you. And to remember that aspect of humanity, of shared humanity, is important. Thank you. what would you think would be the answer? And what would be the way you'd predict? So the way in which it's predictable is founded on the fact that there's only the Dharma, you know, there's only one Dharma, there's only the way things actually are. And any practice through any path will start to, you know, reveal that to you. And when you see that, then it has some of a kind of constellation of natural effects. So there is a predictable way. And the way it will specifically unfold for you or for any being is going to be completely unique. And the way it will manifest in your life is going to be specific to your life and completely unpredictable. And any predictions that you make about the way that it's going to work for you, I would bet you good money you're not going to be right. So let me know if you want to take that bet. We can shake on it. But so yes, but also part of the way that, you know, compassion can manifest, you know, and wisdom can manifest is by an increasing realization of how compassionate we are not. And so, you know, you might think that to become more compassionate and be wiser means you're going to be manifesting more compassion and you're just going to radiate glowy light to all beings under all circumstances. But in fact, the way it might manifest for you is just really clearly seeing all of the turmoil and anger and hatred and aversion and stuff in your heart. And really being with that, that might be the way that your compassion manifests. Might be what wisdom is for you. You know, I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago about that. For me, what it manifested as is just kind of just suffering better, you know, which is not what I would have thought that it was. A really, really good book about that kind of, about the that that the way in which compassion and peace might manifest as an awareness of how peaceful we aren't is called Pavement by Lynn Jensen. It's a really good book. It's also a book about the wisdom of not knowing. So it's predictable and it's unpredictable. In other schools of Buddhism, they have, in the Tibetan Buddhism, there's something called the Lam Rim, which is the graduated path, which is a very, very detailed thing about progress and what to do and how it's going to unfold. And in insight meditation or Theravada Buddhism, there are things called the jhanas, which are these 10 levels which go in a predictable order. And, you know, to attain the first jhana, you do these things, and then you have this insight, and then you do these things, and then you attain this other insight. And those kind of do happen predictably, but our school Zen doesn't emphasize either of those kinds of things, you know. But in the koan curriculum, there are koans that unfold in a certain order. So if you take up that path, there's a way in which it kind of does unfold predictably, but even within that, it's completely unpredictable. And also, whatever you predict about how it's going to be predictable is going to be wrong. So, but in retrospect, you see. it's one of those Zen answers of definitely yes and definitely no. Thank you, guys.